Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the latest Marquette Law School poll was released today. We'll talk to the head of the survey to find out where voters stand less than a week before the 2020 general election draws to a close. First, it's the week in Washington where we take a look at several top stories in national politics, and it's less than a week until that final day of voting in the election. We're going to hear some closing arguments from the two presidential candidates out on the campaign trail and check out a couple other big stories along the way. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been following any of the latest rallies and campaign events for Donald Trump and Joe Biden? Have you attended any of them, in person or virtually? What do you think about the closing messages from the candidates, their final pushes to win over and motivate voters? What's been a difference maker for you? How do you feel at this point in the election season? Fatigued? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Tolu Olorunipa is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
In just a minute, we're going to listen to part of the messages from President Trump and former Vice President Biden. But give us kind of the state of affairs right now. Where are the candidates focusing their time, energy, and money right now?
Yeah, it's really the tale of two very different campaigns. For President Trump, he is traveling, barnstorming the country, holding multiple rallies a day. He is going to all different swing states, including Wisconsin, multiple times and trying to see if he can eke out a victory between now and Election Day. For Joe Biden, it's a much different picture. He is also traveling, going to multiple states, but not holding these big rallies, essentially feeling pretty confident in his position at this point, feeling like he's leading in the polls. He has a number of pathways to get to 270 votes. Today, he was in Delaware and he gave a speech about coronavirus pandemic. He did not travel out to any swing states. And I think it's a very clear contrast between what the two candidates are doing. President Trump feeling that he needs to sort of pull a rabbit out of his hat in order to win. So he's trying to feverishly run around the country and travel and hold multiple rallies, even though many of the places where he is going have increasing numbers of coronavirus cases, and a lot of the attendees at his rallies do not practice social distancing, do not wear masks. So he is trying to, you know, downplay the coronavirus. He's been saying that we're rounding the turn. It's not a big deal. It's not a problem. You know, vaccines are coming soon. While Joe Biden has really been honing in on, you know, criticizing the president for his response to the virus and doing so in a much more socially distanced way, in which he's not having big crowds and he's not traveling as much. So it's two very different campaigns, and they have different levels of confidence at this point in whether or not they are going to be able to win once the votes are tallied next week.
Now, stand by for a moment, Tolu. I want to give a listen to minute-ish samples of what the candidates have had to say. You mentioned the coronavirus. Here's some of what they've had to say in their closing messages, not directly related to COVID-19. First of all, President Trump speaking yesterday in West Salem here in Wisconsin.
This election is a choice between a Trump super recovery or a Biden depression. That's what you're going to have with a raise of taxes. The biggest tax increase in our history. It's ridiculous. It's a choice between a Trump boom or a Biden lockdown. Let's lock it all down. And by the way, speaking of lockdowns, let's get you, Governor, to open it up. Let's get him to open it up. It's a choice between our plan to cut your taxes or even, and I have to tell you, you know, we've given you the biggest tax cut in the history of our country. You know that. Biggest regulation cut in the history of our country. And Sleepy Joe Biden, his plan is to raise your taxes at a level that our country has never raised taxes before. Somehow that doesn't work too well. Do you agree?
Some exaggeration on the degree of tax cuts and hikes, but the general message there. Here's Biden speaking yesterday in Warm Springs, Georgia, referencing, he said, charlatans and con men who appear throughout our history.
They appear when the nation's been hit the hardest. We're at our most vulnerable. Never to solve anything, but only to benefit themselves. In a recent encyclical, Pope Francis warns us against this phony populism that appeals to, quote, the basest and most selfish instincts. He goes on to say, Politics is something more noble than posturing, marketing, and media spin. These sow nothing but division, conflict, and oblique cynicism. He said, for those who seek to lead, we do well to ask ourselves, why am I doing this? Why? What is my real aim? Pope Francis asked questions that anyone who seeks to lead this great nation should be able to answer. And my answer is this. I run to unite this nation and to heal this nation. I've said that from the beginning. It's badly necessary.
So two contrasting tones there to Lou, just two samples of a lot of talking by both candidates. But does that kind of capture their approach to how they're talking in the run-up to the end of the election?
Yeah, definitely. That is what we have been hearing on the campaign trail. We've seen these two different candidates offering different messages. President Trump has wanted to say, I am the candidate that's going to bring the economy back. It's not going to allow there to be any more shutdowns. It's going to put the coronavirus behind us by essentially ignoring it and not talking about it and not having people practice all the different mitigation practices, which have, you know, made the economy to shrink and caused a lot of people to lose their jobs as different states have tried to get control of the virus. While Biden has said that Trump has failed in his test as president, he has failed to control the virus, he has failed to follow the science. He has not shown good leadership in this effort in trying to make sure that people are following the right practices of wearing masks and socially distancing and trying to keep themselves from getting infected. The former vice president has criticized Trump for himself getting infected and for there being outbreaks within the White House. So there are two very different messages on this issue of the pandemic, which for a lot of voters is the top issue that they're voting on. They want a candidate that's going to align with their views on how to respond to this pandemic, whether that means completely moving on and not allowing there to be any more mitigation, no more shutdowns, or maybe someone who wants a candidate who would be more willing to listen to the scientists and follow some of the mitigation practices that have been put in place in order to get control of the virus and in order to not have it, you know, surging to record levels as it is now in so many different parts of the country. So this is an issue that is dominating this race. It's leading to a lot of enthusiasm on both sides of the aisle. And it is something that I believe that both candidates are going to continue to talk about in the final 6 days of this race.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post, looking at the top stories in national politics, including the home stretch in the election campaign. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Elkhart Lake. Catherine, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Catherine?
Well, I was watching Trump at his rally in Lansing, Michigan, and all he talked about for a long period of time was how fabulous his rallies were, biggest crowds ever. I'm working my ASS off. I mean, he's such a crude man anyway. His persona is so, but it's always all about him, not a word about what he would try to do continuing with the pandemic, constantly saying, we're going around a corner now. It's getting better. The numbers are great. We're going to open this country up. What has he done to us? First of all, withholding critical information in January from President Xi of China, telling him how bad this was, not stepping up immediately and telling his fellow Americans what was coming our way. And now he just says, all we talk about is COVID, 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 COVID. And the things that he says to members of the media, I've been a member of the media for 40 years. So is my husband for a national network. What he has done and said about reporters and correspondents, calling us names and the enemy of the people and garbage and fake news. We have been held hostage to lies and insane behavior with this man. And all
Catherine, I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot to work with. Thank you for calling in. First of all, she's not liking the president's persona, his attacks on the media, tapes she was referring to, I think, from Bob Woodward of the president talking about the seriousness of the disease. Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, more tapes of him talking about it earlier. But none of that seems to have bothered the president's supporters in 2016. Any reason to think it would be different this time around, Tolu?
Well, you did have a lot of people who voted for the president despite his commentary despite his crudeness. They thought that they would like his policies and that he would sort of merge into the role and become more presidential and leave behind sort of his show business personality. And a lot of those voters have left the president. A lot of suburban voters have said, you know, I'm out. This is not what I signed up for. I did not want a president who was going to cause my blood pressure to rise every time he goes on TV, or, as a caller said, would always be speaking in such a crass and crude manner and not focusing on the major issues that face the country, instead sort of focusing on his own vanity and his big crowds and the fact that he can get a lot of people to show up in the middle of a pandemic. So he has lost some voters. He has not lost his core supporters, who are with him all the way. They're very enthusiastic. They like the fact that he is defiant. They like the fact that he goes against the grain. He goes against political norms. So for those core supporters, they continue to be with the president, and they are enthusiastic, and they may have even grown in number in terms of more people joining that force. But when it comes to some of those more moderate voters who backed the president in 2016, maybe because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, a lot of them are feeling okay voting for Joe Biden. They've been turned off by Trump, that they, you know, can't see themselves voting for him again. And that could be the margin in a lot of these states where it's expected to be very close, and the president's base alone will not be enough to get him to the number that he needs in order to win. So that is a very interesting dynamic to watch. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and passion in opposition to the president now that we didn't see in 2016. We always saw the enthusiasm of his base, but now we're seeing this sort of resistance movement, which has grown in size and with its passion, and that could really impact what we see. We are already seeing it in very large early vote numbers, but it could really impact what the final tally is once all the votes are counted.
We're talking to White House reporter from the Washington Post, Tolu Olorunipa, in our week in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching either candidate on events virtually or in person? What are you hearing from them? Do you like what you're hearing? What races are you watching around the country? We don't have a Senate race, a U.S. Senate race here in Wisconsin. Are you watching that campaign? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Tolu Olorunipa from the Washington Post, looking at the top stories in national politics, which means, yes, mainly election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, hopes, fears in the run-up to the last day of voting. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Tolu, it's no secret, Wisconsin, a hot contest here. Both candidates pretty much need to win Wisconsin, mostly, if they want to win. You focused in on another state that's maybe more of an unexpected contest, Georgia. What's going on there?
Yeah, surprisingly, Georgia has become a major swing state in this election. Republicans have won the state in basically every election going back to the early 90s, and it's not a state that Democrats have had a lot of success in, especially recently. It's been seen as traditionally a Republican state, but part of some of those trends that I was talking about earlier with suburban voters and moderate voters fleeing from the Republican Party, fleeing President Trump, is really starting to have an impact on Georgia. We're seeing the suburbs of Atlanta really turn out at high levels. And what we saw in 2018 was a relatively close race for governor. And I think Democrats realized that they could have a competitive race in Georgia. And the polling has come back showing Biden slightly ahead, slightly in the lead, and with a real shot at winning the state's 16 electoral votes. That's not something that most people would have expected at the beginning of this race. But because the race has been so close, because President's numbers there are not great, Joe Biden decided to travel to Georgia and hold a couple campaign events there, with the hope that maybe he could pick off a state that has been won by Republicans consistently in the last few elections. So it shows how much this race has really been upended by not only the president's poor numbers, but the coronavirus pandemic and shifting demographics, and the idea that there may be a surge in turnout that could put a number of states in play in different ways than we expected. And we have already seen very high turnout levels in a number of different states, including Georgia, just in the early vote. And it's an indication that people are really passionate about this election. People are paying a lot of attention, And it's not just Democrats that are turning out at this point. Now we're seeing a lot of Republicans turn out in their early voting period, and there's the expectation that Republicans will turn out at a higher rate on election day than Democrats, who are more prone to using mail-in ballots or voting early. So this race could come down to the wire, and states like Georgia could end up being pivotal in whichever candidate ends up on a path to 270 votes.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Kelly is with us in Green Bay. Kelly, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about,
Kelly? I wanted to talk about how I'm in my early 30s, and I've been having a lot of conversations with my parents who are undecided, I would say. They're definitely not interested in Trump, but they don't feel passionate about voting for Biden. And it's always surprising to me when talking to them about the two candidates that they always seem to get stuck on a little thing that comes out about Biden or an accusation that Trump makes about Biden. Although it has no, meat to go off of. And I constantly remind them, you know, it's all of the things that have happened with Trump. He's been impeached, but it seems like they get kind of hung up on those one little thing about Biden because they're not so passionate about either one.
Interesting, Kelly. Thanks a lot for that call. A lot there we could go into, Tolu. Older voters, for one thing, the Trump campaign strategy to try to find that one little thing that'll deter people from voting for Joe Biden. I don't know. What does that make you think about?
Yeah, those are the two issues that I think came up from that call. And in part, Trump is not doing as well with older voters in the polls as he did in 2016. There's a sense that demographic group is shifting away from Trump, in part because of his handling of the coronavirus. A lot of older voters see Joe Biden as someone who would be better at handling the virus, and also don't agree with the president's approach to the presidency. He's been much different than the presidents they've seen over the years. He's been much more crude. And I think that has driven away a large number of older voters. But there are a lot of voters that are in the same position of not necessarily liking Trump, but not feeling passionate about Joe Biden, feeling like he has a number of different flaws, feeling like President Trump's statements about him, including the fact that he has been in Washington for 4 decades, is something that they think about. Do they want a career politician to go back into the White House after having Trump in the office for 4 years? Do they want to return to the kind of president that we may have had in the past? Or do they like the fact that President Trump has been a disruptor and that things are different in Washington than they were before? And there are a number of different allegations from the Trump campaign about Biden, whether it's allegations of corruption, allegations of, you know, things that he failed to do as vice president. And that does make it difficult for some voters to pull the lever for Biden. A lot of those allegations are unsubstantiated, as the caller said. They don't have a lot of meat to them. They are questionable on their face. But sometimes in politics, all you have to do is sort of have the cloud of scandal around someone. And that could really give a lot of voters pause as to whether or not they want to vote for that candidate. So that's what the Trump campaign has been trying to do. They've been pushing a lot of these allegations at Joe Biden. You've had President Trump on the debate stage calling Biden a corrupt politician, saying that he got rich while he was in office, and all of these different allegations, a lot of them that do not have evidence to back them up. But it has worked with a number of voters who are sort of worried about not liking either candidate and maybe feeling like maybe they should stay home or vote for a third party candidate or just leave the presidential ticket blank as they go to vote. So that's something that we'll be watching very closely as we look at who votes, who stays home, and whether or not these attacks from the Trump campaign end up working.
Thanks for the call, Kelly. We're talking to Tolu Olorunipo from The Washington Post, looking at some top stories in national politics. Well, it's the never-ending story, Tolu. Are we going to have another COVID-19 economic relief package from Congress and the White House? Right now, it looks like not. Negotiations have stalled in part because of that and coronavirus stock market drifting downward today. What is the latest on the talk of a potential relief package?
Well, they're not really happening. There's not much talking going on in Congress. The Senate adjourned and they went home, and they will likely not be back until after the election if they follow the plan that they have in place. And that means no pandemic stimulus deal before the election. They had been talking all the way going back to July The White House, the Democrats, and some Republicans had been trying to hammer out a deal to get people relief, and it just didn't come together. President Trump was not able to bring together a deal. There was too much disagreement between the Democrats and the Republicans. A lot of Republican senators did not want to be on record spending, you know, maybe $2 trillion in taxpayer money on another relief package when they didn't know what the outcome of the election will be. So right now, we are seeing the ramifications of that with the stock market dropping significantly. We're seeing coronavirus cases spike, and a lot of the relief would have been about trying to crush the virus, trying to get more testing, more contact tracing, get people back into schools. And we're not going to see that, at least in the short term. There's a potential that it happen after the election, depending on what happens. But there's also the potential that, especially if Joe Biden wins, that this will not come into place until January or February, especially since the inauguration will not be until late January. So it could be several more months of people waiting for relief, and that is not the outcome that the markets were looking for. It's not the outcome that a lot of struggling families are looking for, and it's something that could impact this election with a number of people who were hoping for that relief, showing their views at the ballot box and maybe voting for or against certain candidates because, their relief package did not come, or some people may be staying home because they felt like Washington once again did not work for them. So it is something that's having a major impact, and just as we head into the winter with a rising number of cases, there's no relief coming from Washington, and a lot of Americans are going to struggle on their own, at least for the next few weeks.
Talu, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Talu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. He joined us for our Week in Washington, where we looked at the state of the presidential campaign with just under a week remaining until the last day of voting. Coming up after the news, speaking of the elections, we'll get the latest results from the Marquette Law School poll, see where Wisconsinites stand in the presidential race, and their thoughts about efforts to deal with COVID-19. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, a new investigative report digs into the Foxconn project and what it has and hasn't happened as part of the company's big deal with Wisconsin. That reporter joins the show tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, voting draws to a close next Tuesday, and the latest Marquette Law School released today reflects where people stand on the presidential matchup between incumbent Republican President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. Our next guest joins us to break down the results and what they can mean for Election Day and beyond. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Charles, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here. Thank you.
Before we get into the results, give us your usual disclaimers about what a poll is and is not.
Well, this is a sample of 806 Wisconsin registered voters, and the likely voters are 749. There's a margin of error of plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. But the most important thing is that polls don't determine the outcome of the election. The voters do. And so it's up to the voters to decide how this election turns out.
All right. The question I think everybody's watching for, what does the poll tell us about likely voters and the presidential race in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a 5-point Biden lead, 48-43, 2% for Jorgensen. And we still have 7% that either haven't made up their minds or declined to answer the question about how they were going to vote. That's unchanged on the margin from earlier in the month when it was 47-42. And if you look back since May, we've had Biden ahead by 4 points, 6 points, 5 points, 4 points, and now 5 points, and again 5 points this time. So 5 points plus or minus one is right where the poll has been for the last 5 months.
And again, to hammer down what this means, that is not a prediction that the vote tally will end up being a 5% spread. It's more likely that Biden wins from your polling as we see it. It is there is a chance within that polling and within the margin of error, of course, for President Trump to win Wisconsin, right?
It's likely at this point, at this snapshot in time, that Biden is ahead as of the time we did our polling from last Wednesday through this past Sunday. We learned very clearly in 2016 that the polls can be wrong. Voters can change their minds at the last minute. And we saw that happen in 2016. And so everyone should keep that in mind. But this is why I say the outcome lies in the hands of the voters, not in the polls.
Let's talk about that mind-changing possibility, though. You asked voters, and I don't know if you've done this in years past, you asked how certain people were about their decision to vote. What did you find out?
Yeah, and people are pretty made up. 91% said their minds are made up. 6% said they might change. And among Biden supporters, 95% mind made up. Among Trump supporters, 93% mind made up. We're also seeing that when we push undecideds a little bit and say, well, if you had to decide today, they're splitting evenly and only really raising both Biden and Trump by a single percentage point. And finally, for those people who are undecided, we look to see if they like Biden but don't like Trump, or if they like Trump but don't like Biden. And if either of those two things were true, we allocate them as a Biden vote or a Trump vote. The effect of doing that, again, was to raise both candidates by 2 percentage points, putting Biden at 50 and Trump at 45. But that same 5-point margin that we see with all likely voters and without allocating votes.
And that's interesting, because if I read 2016 right, part of the story there was a lot of the undecided voters, a disproportionate share of them, went to Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. Is that right?
Yes, and that's very strongly shown in the exit polls, where the people that decided in the last week in Wisconsin went 2-1 for Trump over Clinton in the exit polls. Also, there are fewer people undecided. As I said, we're at about 7% now. But we were well over 10 in the mid-teens in 2016. So there are also fewer people that are having trouble making up their minds this year.
One other interesting election-related question you asked voters, was their confidence in a reliable count of the vote? And it looks like, by and large, Wisconsin feels pretty good about things. Is that right?
Yes, I would say so. 27% of likely voters say they're very confident the vote will be accurately counted. Another 43% somewhat confident. But then we get to the skeptics, 21% not too confident and 7% not at all confident. So there's definitely some skepticism there. Republicans a little less confident, 61% say they're very or somewhat confident versus 82% of Democrats who are very or somewhat confident.
Talking to Charles Franklin about the latest Marquette Law School poll, the last one before the presidential election. A lot of questions directly about the presidential election, Charles, but you also asked questions related to other big issues like COVID-19. What kind of things did you ask people? What did they have to say?
Well, we asked, first of all, one that we've been asking all year, and that is, how worried about getting COVID are you? And paradoxically, the worry actually dropped off in this poll from 3 weeks ago, despite the fact that our case count has gone up so much. 27% were very worried at the beginning of the month, and 22% are very worried now. Up until now, that number has risen and fallen as our cases have gone up or gone down. So it's a little funny that it went down even as our cases and death count are skyrocketing. But at the other end, there's about 20%, 19% in this poll, but about 20% since May who have said they're not at all worried about the virus, and they have not responded up or down as the epidemic has proceeded.
How about the way we're behaving, wearing masks, things like that?
64% say they always wear a mask in public. Another 20% most of the time. 12% do it just now and then, and 3% say they never do it. We also asked about being comfortable eating inside a restaurant. And 52% say they are comfortable eating in. 47% say they're not. But back in May, when we first asked this question, it was the reverse. 42% were comfortable and 57% uncomfortable back then. So people have gotten a little more used to the idea of eating out. And again, ironically, even at a time when case levels are going up very rapidly here in the state.
Did you try to get a feel for how attitudes toward COVID-19 were affecting the presidential race, bringing things back around?
Sure, we do. And we look to see, first of all, what is President Trump's job approval on handling COVID? And that has ticked down a percentage point this month to 40% approve from 41% earlier this month, at the beginning of the month. 58% disapprove, so that's a net negative 18 points. In a statistical analysis, we find that partisanship and overall job approval are the two most powerful predictors of vote. But COVID is this COVID approval of Trump's handling of his job is the third most important. And both the economy and handling of protests are about half as important as the COVID opinion. So that's our evidence that while the overall job and party drives a lot, COVID is still playing a role.
I want to take a look at how people can compare and contrast polls they see, because another fresh new poll, this one from Washington Post, ABC, I'm guessing you've looked at this, has Biden with a much bigger lead in Wisconsin. Was it 17 points or something like that?
17.
What do you tell people when they see two poll results that vary so much? How can we assess why they're so different?
Well, first of all, we'll find out sometime next week. So that's one thing. Let's just wait. But look, in polling, outliers do occur. And the ABC Washington Post poll is one of the most respected polls around. When you do a poll, you're obligated to do the best job you know how. But once you have the results, you're ethically required to just report those results. And not say, oh, I don't know, there's something wrong with this, I'll hide this result or I won't report it. So, you know, hats off to the Post and ABC for putting this out there and in their stories dealing, frankly, with it being an outlier. But we'll find out in a week, you know, where the election actually ends up.
And as we start to wrap up, what demographic group are you watching most closely in Wisconsin and for changes compared to 2016?
I think it's the non-college educated white women and the college educated white men. Those were the two groups that shifted the most between 2016 in the presidential race and 2018 in the governor and Senate races here. The other white voter groups of non-college men and college women are kind of equal and opposite groups, and they've been pretty stable at around 60%, 30% in opposite directions for most of the year. They're a little bit tighter in this latest poll, but still equal and opposite. But these two middle groups of non-college white women and college white men have been the swing groups. We're not seeing much change among black voters or Hispanic voters this year. They've been pretty stable all year.
And as we wrap up, it was a tight margin in the race for president in 2016 in Wisconsin and the races for governor and attorney general in Wisconsin 2018. A small move among one or two of these groups can make a big difference, right?
Yes. You know, there's both the question of turnout right now. We know that we've gotten an awful lot of early votes, but we don't know how many of those are actually new voters or simply people shifting from election day to early. Likewise, we know how many people haven't voted yet, and we'll see if they turn out in lower than expected numbers or possibly higher than expected numbers on election day. Those are the biggest sources of uncertainty at this point.
Charles, thanks as always for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He joined us to talk about the results from their latest survey of Wisconsin voters in the home stretch in this year's election. Coming up, for WPR reporters from around the state look at how the makeup of Wisconsin's legislature may change as a result of next week's election. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The nation's eyes are locked on Wisconsin because of its potentially critical role in the presidential campaign. But three races for state Senate that are also on the ballot could guide the direction of state government next year, potentially for the next decade. If Republicans win all three and flip three seats in the state assembly while holding on to their current seats, they'd capture a veto-proof majority in the legislature, which would let them set the agenda in state government even when Democratic Governor Tony Evers objects. If they fall short, it preserves divided government in Wisconsin and guarantees Democrats a seat at the table. Wisconsin Public Radio has reports on those races. First up, here's Rich Kramer on the Western Wisconsin contest between Democrat Patty Schachner and Republican Rob Staffschuld.
Western Wisconsin's 10-state Senate district had been a suburban stronghold for Republicans for decades, until 2018, when Democratic newcomer Patty Schachner won the seat by 11 percentage points. Schachner says her three main priorities are improving access to health care, ensuring residents have clean water, and good public schools.
I want to make sure that my kids and grandkids can grow up with the same experiences and opportunities that I had.
Schachner also promotes herself as bipartisan. She joined Republicans in 2019 to vote for a bill preventing discrimination against people with disabilities at voting sites.
This bill now made it possible for thousands more Wisconsinites to cast their ballot, regardless of their ability or disability. And I'm really proud of that.
Schachner has also pushed, unsuccessfully, for an expansion of Medicaid by accepting federal funds through the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have repeatedly blocked that expansion. Schachner won this seat in a low turnout special election. Now GOP leaders are working to flip it back to Republican control. Her opponent is Rob Staffschuld of New Richmond, who's been a state representative since 2016. Staffschuld prides himself as a fourth-generation farmer and lifelong resident of St. Croix County, which makes up a sizable chunk of the district.
And I'd just like to take my experience as a small business owner and a farmer and a father and expand that to a little bit bigger terrain here and cover the 10th Senate District.
Staffschuld said in the last state legislative session he was proud to vote with Democrats on a COVID-19 relief package that, among other things, lifted a waiting period for unemployment benefits. Both Staffschuld and Schachner support rural broadband funding, but Staffschuld points out that he voted for it as part of the last state budget.
Had he voted against that bill? And so when you're talking about broadband expansion, you kind of got to walk the walk.
One potential wild card is President Trump and how he might affect races down the ballot. St. Croix County is a Twin Cities suburb, and Trump has struggled with suburban voters elsewhere. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Rich Kramer.
And I'm Megan Hart. For 20 years, Democratic State Senator Dave Hansen has represented the 30th Senate District in Green Bay. He announced his retirement in January. Now his nephew, Jonathan Hansen, is hoping to take up the mantle. For 3 years, he's been an alderman in De Pere. The Democrat says Madison could benefit from operating more like local government.
Especially with this pandemic, we've seen just a total abdication of leadership by Republicans in Madison. So it's really left local governments to try to fill the vacuum of leadership.
Hansen worked with city staff to create a pandemic relief program for small businesses in De Pere, which he says has been a lifeline. Hansen believes gerrymandering and health care are critical issues this election. He supports offering a public option through Badger Care and accepting Medicaid expansion. Mostly, he thinks voters are looking for politicians focused on getting things done.
I'm not a hardcore ideologue. I'm somebody that is really just focused on common sense solutions.
He says that's in contrast to his opponent, Republican Eric Wimberger. Wimberger says a lot of the divisiveness in politics today is the result of government overstepping its mandate. He says his political philosophy boils down to the fact that 48% of people will disagree with almost any move the government makes.
So government shouldn't be getting into other people's business and telling them what to do and taking their money and saying what the right thing for them is.
Wimberger says the voters of Northeast Wisconsin identify with his blue-collar background. He worked in a factory, bartended, and drove a truck to put himself through law school. He also joined the Marines, where he was a lawyer. The De Pere native now owns a local law firm, and his history as an attorney has come up during the campaign. Democrats, including Hansen, have attacked him for statements he made while representing clients accused of sexual assault and child pornography. Wimberger says he finds the tactic stunning.
He claims that there's injustice in the criminal justice system, but then he's attacking me, the only guy on the other side, being a check on that.
Wimberger says he places a higher priority on public safety than his opponent does. He's been endorsed by the sheriffs of Brown, Oconto, and Marinette counties, the three counties that fall in the district. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Megan Hart.
And I'm Hope Kerwin. There's a rematch this year in Western Wisconsin's 32nd Senate District, as two La Crosse area natives vie for a seat left open by former Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling, who resigned in May. Schilling has endorsed Democrat Brad Paff. He previously worked for Congressman Ron Kind and was the state director for the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Obama administration. Most recently, Paff has been in the thick of Wisconsin's contentious state politics. Governor Tony Evers appointed him to lead the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. But when Paff criticized some Republicans for withholding mental health funding for farmers, the state Senate took the rare step of firing him. During his campaign, Paff has described himself as someone who can rise above partisanship.
Our politics right now is too divisive. It doesn't have to be like that. We can come together to solve the problems that we've got.
Paff has called for increasing investment in roads and rural broadband, as well as new money for equity training for law enforcement. And he says he has the experience to help struggling farmers in the district that have been underserved by the legislature.
They're hurting. And quite frankly, there's an awful lot of talk that's taking place, and there's not a lot of action.
Paff ran for the 32nd Senate seat in 2004, but he lost that race to Republican Dan Kopanky, who is running again this year. Kopanky worked for 20 years as a seed salesman and is the owner of an amateur baseball team in La Crosse. He served as state senator until 2011, when he was recalled in the wake of Act 10. Kopanky narrowly lost a bid for the seat in 2016, and he says he's back this year because he's a people person.
I'm passionate about where we live, the people in this district, and my intent here is to go to Madison and represent these people in the manner in which they should be represented.
Kopanky has criticized the governor's approach to addressing COVID-19, saying a recent executive order limiting capacity at bars and restaurants picks winners and losers. He says farmers should be allowed to grow larger without being overregulated, and he called for supporting law enforcement instead of seeking reforms. But in contrast to many Republicans in the state, Kopanky says he would be open to accepting federal Medicaid dollars to help expand access to health care.
With COVID, the dynamics have changed, and I get to Madison. If I would get to Madison, I would be open to accepting those dollars.
The 32nd Senate District has a history of flipping back and forth between parties. It's one of several Western Wisconsin races, from state assembly to Congress, that could prove pivotal in this year's election. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Hope Kerwin.
Tomorrow at noon, join WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky and reporters from around the state, including Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, Capitol reporter Laurel White, Milwaukee-based reporter Corrine Hess, and Wausau-based reporter Rob Menser for a conversation about the 2020 elections in Wisconsin. They'll cover perspectives on key issues from around the state just days before the end of the election. We'll have time for questions from you as well, so let us know what's on your mind. You can register. Go to WPR.org/presents. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll hear arguments for both major party candidates for president from Wisconsin guests making a last pitch in the final days of voting. The pandemic has been a good time to tackle home improvement projects, and a lot of people are ready to do more as they nest for winter. A Wisconsin expert joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. And what happens to our clothing and other stuff after we donate it? A guest shares the hidden world of secondhand stuff and why a lot more things go to waste than we might think. Plus, tips for dealing with stress and anxiety people might be feeling in the midst of a pandemic and a tough election. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A couple of weeks back, I gave you a heads up on the ultimate Halloween yard decoration, a complete skeleton of an actual Tyrannosaurus Rex. Is going on sale for lots of money. So, okay, nobody, I think, in Wisconsin took me up on that. But let's look a little farther ahead at another sale that one possible purchaser calls the holy grail of Christmas movie props. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, you can own Santa Claus and Rudolph, the actual figurines used in the stop-motion Rudolph Christmas special from 1964. They go on auction on November 13th. They're expected to sell for $150,000 to $250,000 for the pair. The figures were featured in the classic animation special that tells the heartwarming story of a young reindeer who's mocked and ignored by classmates and family members until it turns out he can be useful to them. The figures were made by Japanese designer Ichiro Komuro out of wood, wire, cloth, leather, and yak hair. Santa stands about 11 inches tall, while Rudolph is about 6 inches high. They always say the TV camera adds weight, apparently some height, too. Okay, if you pay 6 digits for these little guys, you're probably not going to put them out in the rain and snow. So maybe just put a Santa hat on that T-Rex instead. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.